This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So last week, we sent out a tweet asking 20-somethings if they feel stuck and why. And we got this response from Elizabeth Agate.
Student debt. I'm saddled with it, and I only have a bachelor's. I'd love to go back to school for nursing, but I can't imagine adding to my debt.
Now, we know what you may be thinking. You know how she feels because maybe that's you, or your siblings, or your friends, or your children. In other words, it's not exactly news that many people are feeling burdened by their student loans.
But what is news is exactly how many people and who they are. A new study from the Pew Center finds that 1 in 5 American households, that's 20%, carries some kind of student loan debt. That's the highest percentage ever. For households headed by someone younger than 35, the number soars to a record 40%.
Joining us now to talk more about these numbers and what the Pew Research Center found is Richard Fry. He's Senior Research Associate at the Pew Hispanic Center. Mr. Fry, welcome to Radio Boston.
Delighted to be with you today.
So can you briefly take us through your most sort of surprising findings here? I mean, the top line that people have been talking about is that 20% of households across the United States have some kind of student loan debt. So how does that break down in amongst the household? Who's actually carrying that debt?
This is these are households that we're talking about. So, for example, let's suppose you have two college grads and they're married to each other. This is their combined debt, and this is what they still currently owe. This is their outstanding debt obligation. As far as top line findings, they're sort of twofold, I would say, is you picked up one. It's just sort of now almost 1 in 5 households as of 2010. It's up sharply. It was only 15% back in 2007, only 9% in 1989. So student debt is a rising obligation that more and more households are dealing with. I think in terms of sort of the other sort of real important sort of top line findings is to sort of say, okay, 1 in 5 households is dealing with student debt. What kind of amounts are we talking about? Are we talking about, you know, $15,000? Are we talking $100,000? And what you sort of see is this. For many households, I guess I would use I would describe it as modest, manageable. Indeed, though, as we'll see, I'll run through the numbers, there's a non-trivial share of households where the outstanding amount of student loan debt is 50, 60, 70, 80,000. So let's just sort of run through the numbers.
Well, if I could just jump in here for a moment before we sort of do the numbers in too much detail, let's take a step back, and because the other big finding, and again, the numbers will help reveal this, is that, for example, that 50, 60, 70,000, the eye-popping numbers, you find that that's really people who end up being high-income earners.
Well,
or households households with more income in general?
No, what I generally tend to find is I take a look at sort of who owes that outstanding $900 billion of outstanding student debt. So, and that's sort of what this data is helpful with, is sort of saying who owns it. It's overwhelmingly owned by younger households. Households with a head younger than 35, they owe 44% of that $900 billion of outstanding student loan debt. It's not surprisingly, it's overwhelmingly owned by households where you have a college grad who's mm-hmm. the head of the households, 70%. It's interesting, another 19% is households where you have a head that hasn't finished a four-year college degree, sort of a some college educated. So it's owned, I would say, generally by younger households, by relatively, according to the standards of the whole U.S. education, by relatively well-educated households. And so now sort of segueing into your focus on income, given that they're relatively well-educated, on average, that means that they would be relatively better off, more affluent, higher income households. And this was sort of what's the important sort of nuance to communicate. It is true that most of the student loan debt is indeed sort of, it's more towards the upper income groups. Okay. The lowest fifth of households, it's 20% of households, it's the lowest fifth by income, that's households less than $21,000. They own in 2010 about 13% of the debt. As opposed to that, the richest fifth, they owe about 31% of all the outstanding student debt. So it is true, okay, it is true that the student debt tends to be owed by more affluent households and better educated households. However, here was the interesting finding. It's up from 2007 for it's widespread. More households owe it. The amounts they owe are up slightly over 3 years. It's pretty widespread. But if you look at the share that's owed, it's the lowest fifth that owes a greater share of a growing pie, and it's the upper fifth that owes a rising share of a rising pie. And then sort of here's the power of this study, is we know a lot of other information about these households. We know their household income. We know their other debts. We know their assets. And so we have a sort of a complete sort of understanding of sort of how the student debt fits into their wider economic circumstances. And this is why the report sort of focuses on the fact that it looks like the stresses, the burdens, are probably on the households with the lowest incomes, those under 21 grand. Granted, they have less of the debt, but they have much less income. And so when you sort of do sort of a student debt to household income, sort of here's what you find. For the lowest fifth of households, their sort of student debt, what they owe, is about 24% of their entire household incomes. Whereas for the upper fifth of households, yes, they have more debt, but they have a lot more household income to sort of handle that debt.
Let me jump in here for a second, because so this is really the point that hit home, or hits home, I think, for most people, is that while you're saying, yes, the dollar value of the student, of who's holding the most student loans, may fall to those households with the highest income, truth is because of that income, they're more likely to be able to pay it off. But when we're talking about the reality of the burden that student debt produces in the lives of certain households, the burden is greatest, as you've written in your report, amongst the lower fifth of income earners. And as you point out in your report, these are households that are less likely than other groups to even attend college in the first place. So I guess my last question for you is now that we have a better sense through your research as to how the debt breaks down across income levels, student loan debt, in the United States, what do you think the impact is going to be of this new understanding? Are we basically, now we know for sure that low-income earners are really bearing the brunt of the explosion in student loans?
I think in looking for warning signs, looking for where the stress points are greatest, I think these Federal Reserve numbers suggest that it's not among the sort of upper income, the better off households, given their other assets, what else they owe, et cetera, rather it's among the lowest earners. The report also makes clear, we talked about income, most households since 2007, this in America is known as the age of deleveraging. Households are sort of shedding their debt obligations. They're doing less credit card debt. During the Great Recession, they bought fewer cars, so there's less car debt. Most households, yeah, they have rising student debt, but they have less of other kinds of debt. So again, that suggests that the debt may be more manageable. For that lowest income fifth of households, they're not successfully deleveraging. They have more vehicle loans. They have more loans for sort of consumer durables like refrigerators and appliances. And so again, when you sort of look at the student debt in the context of the household's complete economics, again, it suggests it's the lowest fifth of households that are probably the most burdened.
Richard Fry is a senior research associate at the Pew Hispanic Center and one of the authors of a new report from Pew about just who owes student loan debt in America and why. Richard Fry, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
So listeners, what is your student loan debt obligation, and does it feel like a burden to you? And when you hear that a record number of American households have some kind of student debt to pay, does that seem like a drag on the country or an education success story? I mean, people need mortgages to buy a house, so why not student loans to get a college degree? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And call us especially if you are one of those people who got a student loan, went to college, and are now thinking, maybe it wasn't worth it. Because here's the thing. For quite some time now, one of the unassailable mantras in higher education has been, if you earn a college degree, over your lifetime, you're going to earn more money. And there are significant data to back this up. A variety of studies show that, on average, lifetime earnings for college grads can be anywhere from $500,000 to $3 million more than high school grads. They can. But the ka-ching factor here depends a lot on what you major in, what jobs you get after college, and how many of those graduate degrees you end up racking up. If we dig into the data a little bit more, things get, well, a little less certain. So let's take a look at just one measurement: median lifetime earnings for someone with a bachelor's degree only. According to the Georgetown Center on Education and Workforce, 14% of people with high school diplomas actually end up earning more than the median wage for a college grad. Almost a third, or about 28%, of people with an associate's degree beat that college median wage too. In other words, there seems to be increasing evidence that rising tuition rates and those ever-increasing debt burdens we just talked about may be eating into that vaunted lifetime income difference between people who have four-year college degrees and people who don't. So yes, it's still a good degree, still a good deal, I should say, but maybe a little less good than it was before. And that shifting reality is leading a lot of people to ask, if the cost of college is challenging the long-term benefits of a college degree, why go at all? We're joined now by William Simons. He's director of Pathways to Prosperity Project. It's at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. It's a program that's aiming to develop, quote, multiple pathways into the workforce. William Simons, welcome to Radio Boston.
My pleasure.
So we just went through a bunch of sort of competing numbers about is it or isn't it worth it to go to college. And you heard about the new sort of examination as to who owes what when it comes to America's total student loan burden. Why is it that at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, you've decided to put forth a lot of effort into helping people perhaps not go to college at all?
Well, the reason we're looking at this issue, Meghna, is that our current system is literally failing millions of young Americans. Many of the people who are listening right now are either unemployed or underemployed, really trying to find their way to success. And what we did was launch a program to help more young people find a road ahead, a successful road ahead.
So, I mean, do you buy into this theory that for some people, college just isn't a good deal in the long run?
Yes, I think it depends on where you're heading with your life. For some professions, you absolutely need to go to college. If you want to be a doctor, if you want to be an engineer, if you want to be a lawyer, although demand for lawyers is dropping, you do need to go to a four-year college, and in most cases, you'll need to go to graduate school as well. But simply going to college does not guarantee that you're going to be a success. And recent research shows that 53% of recent four-year graduates are either unemployed or underemployed. In other words, they've got a four-year degree, but they're working at Starbucks, for example.
But isn't that just a picture? I mean, I don't want to say just as in as to undermine it, but that's a picture of the current effects of the recession that we've been struggling through. It doesn't necessarily mean in the long run we're going to have a, you know, 53% of college grads be under or unemployed.
Hopefully not, but I think it's combined with the fact that, it, as you just pointed out in the Pew study, that the cost of college is skyrocketing, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for young Americans to finance that, and that's why they're taking on so much debt to do that. So in this environment, I think it's more important than ever to look at what education you're getting and where that's leading you and whether or not really that's the best course to follow. We've told too many students that the only pathway to success is to go to a four-year college. What we're suggesting is let's offer students multiple pathways to success. For some of them, following a different route will make more sense.
So can you describe to me, you know, some of these alternative pathways that you're trying to develop? Because, I mean, right now for a certain group of Americans and listeners listening to this, they've never been in an environment where anything other than heading towards college is the message they've gotten from a lot of people in their lives.
Right. Well, that's been the dominant message we've given young Americans over the past generation. But listen to this, Meghna. The Georgetown group that you just cited did another study, and what they found is that there are right now 29 million jobs in the U.S. that do not require a four-year degree, but that pay at least $35,000 a year. 29 million jobs that fall into that category. So $35,000 a year is, you know, at the lower end of the middle class. It's enough to, in many parts of the country, enough to, get by, certainly. Many of them pay a lot more than that. And yet these jobs do not require a four-year degree. Mm-hmm. So the point is there's literally millions of jobs that require less than a four-year degree. They require some college education, but less than a four-year degree.
But on the other hand, if I may, I mean, the Georgetown Center on Education and Workforce keeps coming up because they do a lot of great research on this exact issue. And just in August, and perhaps we're quoting from the same report, but they found that during, they looked at the past 5 years of labor statistics and data, and they found that during the recovery portion of this recession, that the economy added 2 million jobs. And according to them, almost all of those jobs were for college-educated workers. And here's a quote from Anthony Carnevale, who's the head of this Georgetown Center. He basically says this points to the structural change that maybe the recession itself is showing us in the economy, that he says, quote, "The economy that's coming is one where the value of education after high school really determines whether or not you join the middle class." He's looking forward, whereas when we look at perhaps the current day situation or things as they were a generation ago, he says you just can't compare the two.
Right. Well, I'm not disagreeing with what he's saying. He's using the term college to mean education beyond high school.
I see.
What I'm saying is that there's many jobs out there that do require education beyond high school, but less than a four-year degree. And I think that's a critical distinction, because if you go to a community college, a technical college, for example, that's a lot less expensive than going to a four-year college.
We have a lot of callers who want to join us, Mr. Simon, so I want to welcome them in. Sarah is calling from Alston. You're on the air, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to call in because I'm also somebody, I graduated in 2009. I'm somebody who took on a lot of loans. And when I was applying to colleges and getting in and getting financial aid packages, it's just, it's hard to conceive when you're 18 years old exactly how much debt you're taking on. And so I actually got an offer for a full ride from one college. I got the John and Abigail Adams Scholarship, so I was able to attend any of the public colleges, tuition-free in Massachusetts. But when you're 18 years old, you're not really thinking about it. It seems so far away. And I turned them down, and now I'm, 25 years old, and I have around $35,000 in debt. And it's like, I wish I had known, I wish somebody had told me when I was 18 exactly what that would mean and exactly how much money I would have to spend every month out of my paycheck to pay for it.
Sarah, thank you so much for your call. William Simons, is this one, perhaps one of the branches on your pathway to prosperity? Is that, and this is something that I've heard a lot of young people say over time, that no one actually ever talked to them about the reality of what they would be taking on when they go to college.
Absolutely. One of the things we advocate is a lot more emphasis on career and life counseling. So let me tell you another story. I recently met a young man here in the Boston area who's about 21. He went to college, a private liberal arts college, really didn't have the money to pay for it, borrowed $80,000 and dropped out after 2 years. So then he went to see a loan counselor who said, "You're going to have to pay $800 a month for the next 10 years. This is a young man who doesn't have a job and who doesn't really have the skills to get a good job. And yet no one really counseled him at the beginning of this process. Do you know what you're doing? Is this really a good idea for you?"
Let's take another call. Brian is calling from Brookline. You're on the air, Brian.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call and say I'm 24 years old. I am a college dropout. I went to college a bunch of different times, tried a bunch of different schools with a bunch of different things, and every time I felt it didn't work for me. And right now I'm working as a dog walker, actually, and I'm making more money than a lot of my friends with college degrees who are teachers, working at office jobs and stuff. And I just think that it's a pretty funny commentary that I get paid more to walk people's dogs and pick up after their doo-doo than some people do to take care of children.
But, Brian, do you want to be a dog walker forever?
Absolutely not. But the thing is that I do have a job teaching a couple nights a week, and I get paid more to walk the dogs than I do to teach children. And based on that merit, like, I'm going to continue walking the dogs because I need to be making enough money to be able to pay my rent and support.
Brian, thanks so much for your call. Let's take one more here quickly if we can. Marsha's calling from the Back Bay in Boston. You're on the air, Marsha.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point that my husband and I graduated from law school together and took on $120,000 in student loan debt, which we proceeded to pay back every penny over the next 10 years, $800 a month, but we never bought a house. 20 years later, we still have not bought a house because that crippling debt, especially in 1990 when we graduated, which was you know, the housing market just went through the roof after that, it's going to cause a ripple effect. All of the loan debt that kids are taking on now is the biggest problem for them is going to be able to buy homes. And I think it's going to cause our country a next big bubble.
Marcia, thank you so much for your call. William Simons, we've just got about a minute to go here, but Marcia sort of leads me to what continues to be the big question here. And that is, I mean, you're talking about forming a variety of pathways, as you say, to prosperity. Maybe it's in college, maybe it's not. But, I mean, you're sitting there at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. What do you see as the long-term effect of the fact that we do have such a large proportion of people carrying what they feel is an unsustainable debt burden?
I think what it points to is that our current system is not sustainable, and we're going to have to develop a better system of pathways for our young people to succeed. We can't continue increasing the cost of four-year college indefinitely, and we can't ask our young people to take on more and more debt. We've got to stop that cycle and develop a more feasible system. Now, let me just hasten to add, we do believe that young people should go beyond high school. A high school degree alone is not enough. You do need some continuing education, but you don't necessarily have to go to a four-year college.
William Simons is the director of Pathways to Prosperity. It's a project at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. William Simons, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And listeners, we know there's a lot of you out there who have stories to tell about college loans and whether you did or didn't think it's worth it. Send us your stories at radioboston.org. And stay with us because coming up, the homogeneity of home decor. We'll talk with interior architect Cheryl Katz. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.